each meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Hey, welcome everyone. God bless you for tuning in to The Winds Have Changed. This is Wednesday, of course. You know what that means. Spring. Wrinkling Wednesday.
Wow. You just wrinkled my brain, man.
There we go. Now we can start. It's also December 8th. It's all sorts of things that are jumping around in my mind. First and foremost is today's Feast of the Immaculate Conception. It's a beautiful feast day, and it's wonderful to meditate on all the doctrine and the meaning that this feast day brings to mind. And how key it is, in a larger sense. So I want to talk a little bit about that. I also want to mention, I got to have a little bit of COVID communication, especially with the Omicron variant. We gotta talk about that a little bit. And it's also we're in the middle of the novena to Our Lady of Guadalupe. That brings my mind and heart to so many of the stories of Mexico, and they're interesting in and of themselves, just as an interest in world history, but not just because it's world history. It's our neighbor. We who live in the United States should be interested in the history of our neighbor, primarily because there's an underlying theme vis-a-vis the apparition of the Blessed Mother, Our Lady Guadalupe, and the ideological battle that goes on between a culture that is primarily Catholic and one that's primarily Protestant. That's part of our story. Though I love this land of ours, this beautiful country of the United States, it holds a more Protestant culture than a Catholic culture. Mexico held a more Catholic culture than a Protestant culture. That's actually changing, unfortunately, a lot of ways. But to trace some of those stories around and especially related to the place that devotion to the Blessed Mother had. It's ironical in some ways because there's a great deal of external devotion, but fortunately not fully internally understood by so many people. Anyways, first let me throw at you a little bit of thoughts about the Immaculate Conception. It is a doctrine of our faith that the Blessed Mother was born without original sin. Automatically, amazingly, and not surprisingly, it is often thought of as the feast day that honors or proclaims, pronounces our belief that Jesus was born in a miraculous way without a natural mother and father. Yeah, but that's not what the Feast of the Immaculate Conception is all about. It's understandable that those thoughts come to mind because, let's face it, we all know where children come from, and that is a natural a natural thing that is on everyone's mind. It affects everyone's lives. Though the doctrine of original sin is kind of cloudy. It's kind of mysterious. Yeah, so in order to really appreciate this feast of the Immaculate Conception, I have to discuss a little bit about clarifying our thoughts and some of the errors associated with the doctrine of original sin. First and foremost, many times it is criticized because the Bible says that we all have sinned and therefore we are all in need of God's grace. And that is true as it is found in the epistles. However, the logic doesn't negate the possibility of a woman by the name of Mary being born without the original sin, or even sinning throughout her whole life. It's too good to be true, I guess you could say. But the fact that St. Paul says that we are all sinners and all in need of God's grace forgets the point that Adam and Eve were conceived without original sin, right? If the meaning of that passage in the epistles is to be taken as rock-solid evidence that Mary cannot be born except in the state of original sin, that would mean that Adam and Eve couldn't be created without original sin. Of course, that's just not logical because they're the ones who did the original sin. So before they did the original sin, they didn't have the consequences of original sin. Are you following me? Got to keep our P's and Q's together, thinking logically, as it were. And so the idea that Mary was conceived without original sin really is not that much of a credit to her as it is to God. God picked her out for many of her virtues, undoubtedly, and that's to her credit. It's not in this Bible, but so many of the saints and visionaries and legends or historians point out the fact that Mary pretty much grew up in the temple. She was there learning a lot, which was a bit unusual for a young little girl, but she must have learned a lot and was prepared in a very strong way, and especially her inner desires not to get married is a unique, and it's a very strange desire in a young girl. And maybe I like to think in terms of her appreciation of history, and especially, number one, her love for the history of the people of Israel, but also her love for the people of Israel must have also contained with it a frustration with the people of Israel, especially in terms of not following God's ways and not internalizing the commandments as they should be. And so in her mind, obviously through the intercession of the Holy Spirit, she had that desire to make that promise to God, a very private promise, of course, not to get married. And she was dedicating herself to prayer and the study of God and the service of the church, and in the sense that she must have served the people of the temple, and the people came to visit the temple, and all that. So she's such a unique person. She had so many virtues growing up that God perhaps even foresaw her personal choices and laid upon her retroactively or prevenient. That's the word in theology we use. She was given graces before she deserved them because God pre-saw her great virtues. Are you following me? It's kind of It's a beautiful thing. Another way to explain the fact that Mary was saved by Jesus Christ, because there's that other phrase in the New Testament that says we are all in need of the saving grace of Jesus Christ. He died for all. And so many people, especially Protestant Christians, would say there's no biblical foundation for calling Mary immaculately conceived. She must have been a sinner just like everyone else, and therefore Jesus died for her as much as she did for you or me. Though that doesn't logically fit together either, especially if you could consider being saved before the tragedy of sorts. And I like the example of someone being saved off the Titanic as it's sinking vis-a-vis a lifeboat versus someone being saved from the Titanic vis-a-vis not getting on it in the first place, right? If you had a ticket to go to America and ride on the Titanic, and I think there are a few stories of that happening to some people. They were going to go on the Titanic, but circumstances dictated them to miss the trip. Obviously, for the first few hours, they would have been really sad. Oh, darn, I missed that great trip across the Atlantic Ocean. Then when they heard the Titanic sink, they would have thanked their lucky stars for being saved from the Titanic. And in a certain sense, that's a bit of what we might say explains the Immaculate Conception. To me, it seems logical. It doesn't contradict my reason and the beautiful doctrine that comes our way.
Wow. You just wrinkled my brain.
It's helpful. It does wrinkle your brain a bit. Let me throw another angle at you, and then maybe we'll get to these other topics I want to get to. The Feast of the Immaculate Conception and the doctrine of original sin has a lot to do with the way we look at human nature, of course. And I got to throw a little philosophy at you, because it makes me think of the philosopher Immanuel Kant. If you remember, I played a clip a couple weeks ago from Bishop Barron, who says, well, we're all conscient in a certain way. And by that, I what he meant by that was that Kant was famous for his ethical teaching, and his ethical teaching had a lot to do with following the law. And the way you make a law, the way you make a moral law even, is you universalize an individual prescription. You say, I will act this way, and I will call it right if I'd made a universal law out of that action. In other words, I would do something that I would consider right if everyone did the same thing, did it right. It's kind of the simple playground, or maybe it's not so much playground, maybe it's the teacher telling the students, right? If everyone did that, would that work? If everyone ran off a cliff, would you join them? Those kinds of moral principles. And there's a lot of truth to it. However, Immanuel Kant took it even farther. And he used that sense of the only kind of moral teaching you can get are laws that are written and promulgated by a society that is going to make laws that are universalized. That is to say, we'll make a law for this person if the law makes sense for every person. And got to admit, that doesn't sound bad, right? You don't want there to be some laws for me and not for thee. We get that a lot. One of the key problems we're seeing in the news all the time today is hypocrisy, right? And double standards. And we see it with the COVID mandates, where those who make the laws don't follow the laws, et cetera. But hypocrisy and double standard is a logical conclusion of moral relativism. That's why we got to see moral relativism as a problem. And those who are not pointing out this problem are increasing the problem, right? And unfortunately, there's a number of bishops and priests, and I dare say the Pope, Pope Francis, seems to be fanning the fumes of moral relativism by his ambiguous statements and the lack of clear statements, hoping, I'm sure in his mind, the ability to show compassion and the fact that he's ready to love anyone, no matter what they've done or what they're doing, which I could see a noble side to that radical compassion, where you don't want to condemn anyone. You make excuses for others, just like we make excuses for ourselves, right? And yet, that kind of compassion without the right guidance and without the right teaching of a true right and a true wrong it loses its compassionate side because it's creating a society where morals are relative. If you don't point out the fact that no matter what the circumstances, this is right or wrong. It's creating a society in which that moral relativism breeds the kind of hypocrisy and double standards that we're getting over and over again today. Anyways, that's a little bit of the Feast of Immaculate Conception.
Wow.
Wrinkled
my brain.
It is brain wrinkling. I appreciate that. Well, Nick, let's take our first break, right? This hour goes by lickety-split. So, my friends, I am Father Tom Coyes, guest host on The Winds of Change, and you are listening to the new EWTN Catholic Radio Voice for Chicagoland, WSFI Catholic Radio, and on AM 750
and snow
and 88.5.
is just about here. And so, the cold and snow is just about here. And so, Providence Soup Kitchen at St. Stanislaus Kostka is asking for donations of new or used men's winter coats. You may drop them off Monday through Thursday from 9 a.m. to 12 noon at the Soup Kitchen off the church parking lot. St. Stanislaus Kostka is located two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. Thank you for your generosity.
I'm Loretta Freilich, Winds of Change guest host, and you are listening to The Winds of Change.
Welcome to a St. Nicholas Minute. Did you know there was a time when St. Nicholas wasn't so jolly? It was in 325 AD when the bishops gathered in Nicaea for the first ecumenical council. That council was called to answer the false teachings of a priest named Arius. He wrongly taught that Jesus was not the eternal Son of God. He even sang a song with the words, "There was a time when he, Christ, was not." So when Arius repeated those lyrics to the council fathers, I got a little hot under my clerical collar, and I angrily walked up and slapped Arius right in the face. Everyone was shocked. But after regaining my composure, I rejoined the other bishops to approve the Nicene Creed, the same creed that defends the divinity of Christ to this very day. So if you think you're not the stuff saints are made of, just remember, I didn't become jolly old Saint Nick overnight. Christ is born, glorify him.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. God bless you for tuning into The Winds of Change. Father Coyes here on a brain-wrinkling Wednesday. I want to veer into some history because we're in the middle of the novena to Our Lady Guadalupe. We are celebrating the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, and Blessed Mother said to Juan Diego, she is the Immaculate Conception, therefore, that doctrine came along with that apparition, along with her maternal care, as it were. There's so much about the history of Mexico, and there's no way, obviously, you can cover it. I want to zero in on a person, a figure that probably most of us have heard of, at least in the Hispanic community. That is the famous president, Benito Juarez. If we follow his story a bit, I want to illustrate some themes that we as believing Catholics should appreciate when we think of this amazing story. Because, like I said at the beginning there, it helps us appreciate the right and the wrong way to go, or just the very different roads that a culture that is founded on deeper Catholic principles versus those that are founded on the Protestant Christianity and the mix-up of the two. Well, there can be corrupt and sinful Catholics, and there can be good and righteous Protestants. I don't want to disparage the person of you or me or anyone else, but in terms of the principles behind the people, we could see some of them in this here story. So anyways, I want to start it in the sense that the time of Benito Juarez was right around the time of the American Civil War, all right? Kind of gets started right before the American Civil War. It happened right after the Mexican-American War, or I'm going to focus the attention just after the Mexican-American War. And as a matter of fact, Benito Juarez and his buddy Santa Anna were very much a part of, excuse me, the Mexican-American War. So the Mexican Civil War is often pinpointed as something that started in the 1920s or so, with the real persecution of Catholicism which resulted in the Cristero movement. I'm a little amateur historian that says that the history of Mexico is ever since 1810, when they broke away from Spain, that it's a poster boy for almost a constant civil war. And so we're going to focus a bit on that, one of the segments after Spain is shaken off. And that's actually one of the themes that we should appreciate, especially in terms of our Catholic heritage. Of course, our Catholic heritage is supposed to help us see all people of all races and creeds as children of God, and that our moral stand and our belief in one God is certainly much more important than where we were born or who our parents were or grandparents. In other words, ethnicity is not as important as ethical principles. So anyways, Benito Juarez comes onto the scene a little bit before the American Civil War. Benito Juarez, and this is a good important point to know, he was an Indian, a pure Zapotec. Zapotec was a tribe of Indians in Mexico. And that's important because one of the constant calls, obviously, at the beginning of the history of Mexico was the Spaniards who were living there treated the native Indians who were living there poorly. And therefore, that race card was very much a part of the original revolution that threw off Spain. And it was a constant theme throughout just about the next 200 years, namely that, the Indian, native Indian people are second-class citizens, and they still kind of tended to blame the Spaniards, even though the Spaniards were pretty much kicked out all over Mexico. And here we got, there were a number of Mexican presidents who were Native Americans. It had that, it must have had that same kind of feeling when Barack Obama was elected president of the United States. They said, ooh, a black person is now the president. So therefore, that kind of breaks the proverbial glass ceiling of the minorities, you would say. So, but we have to see a veiled hypocrisy or a misnomered cause of the problem. And in Mexico, the misnomered cause of the problem was those darn Spaniards. And they kept on saying that even long after the Spaniards were gone. There were descendants of Spaniards, but most of them were mixed blood. Most of the purebred Spaniards were gone. As a matter of fact, that was some of the laws that they enacted. So anyways, Benito Juarez was a Catholic. As a matter of fact, he was studying for the seminary. He leaves the seminary in 1828 to go to law school, to study law. By the way, the reason I think Benito Juarez is worth studying, he's very famous. The large airport in Mexico City is named Benito Juarez Airport. One time when I was flying in or out of Mexico, landing at Benito Juarez, I turned to somebody and I said, oh, I'm a little nervous flying into Benito Juarez. And they said, why is that? And I said, well, you know, Benito Juarez arrested and had priests killed. And they said, really? I didn't know that part of it. That was part of the purging of the Spaniards, as it were. So anyways, I'm going to read you a bunch of notes here. And a lot of this comes from an amazing book called Blood-Drenched Altars. Very, very documented book by the priest who became a bishop, who was the founder of the Catholic Church Extension Society, Clement Kelly. And he wrote an incredible history of Mexico. Why? Because during the Cristero movement, many priests, religious, many Mexicans fled Mexico, and they ended up in the United States, especially southern United States, where the Catholic Church Extension Society was trying to help Native Indians out in the West, and they found many Mexicans, priests, even bishops. They heard all these stories about what was going on, so Bishop Clement Kelly put together that book on the history of Mexico. Anyways, one of the little details, one of Benito Juarez's right-hand men, a general in his army, Juan Alvarez, he was paid $20,000 a month, and that's a lot of money back then, as a revolutionary. Unfortunately, Juan Alvarez was also known to have raped and even killed a lot of women. He was a bit of a bloodthirsty guy. I guess that's one of the reasons why he was a general in the army, right? There's this big battle between Santa Anna and Benito Juarez. See, Santa Anna was the president before Benito Juarez. Actually, they trade the president's chair what was it, the game where you walk around with musical chairs. That's what I want to say. So let's see. In December 18th, now we're in 1853, President Santa Anna puts Benito Juarez in jail in Veracruz because Benito Juarez was pushing his plan of Ayutla. Maybe you heard that, plan of Ayutla. And the plan of Ayutla had a couple of good things in it, I would have to say. One of the things was he wanted to make Catholicism the official religion of the nation, which I say is a good thing. But in hindsight, you might say, I like the phrase perhaps, most favored religion is better than official religion, because if you say it's the official religion, then you give the state the power to punish people for not being Catholic. And that's not really part of Catholicism, right? Catholicism respects freedom a great deal, and we believe in the truth of all of it because it's the truth, and we don't want to use coercion in any way, shape, or form to make someone Catholic. But anyways, so the other thing is Benito Juarez wanted equal rights for Indians, and that was a good thing. But he also was pushing for kicking all Spaniards out. That happened a number of times, anyways. So after Benito Juarez is let out of jail, Santa Anna doesn't shoot him like so many times political enemies do to each other when there's a war going on. He deports him, Benito Juarez, to the United States. And I think that's key for us to keep in mind, because the United States of America has often been a dumping ground for the problems of other nations. Our neighbor to the south is no exception. Benito Juarez was trouble for Santa Anna and other leaders and what have you. So they kick him out, go to America, see if they take you there. Well, of course, we did take him, and then he goes back, of course, many times. Anyways, so this is going on, and a little bit after that, we're going to see that the chaos in Mexico was noted throughout the world in some ways, and so the powers that be in Europe, especially because when the American Civil War started, American Civil War was obviously one thing about it was definitely about slavery, but the powers that be in Europe didn't see the American Civil War so much as a battle over should slaves be allowed or not. They saw it as this guy, President Lincoln, trying to show the world that a republic like ours could last. So the powers that be in Europe saw the American Civil War and were kind of rooting for America to split apart. In the sense that kings and emperors believe in kings and emperors and empires more than they believe in presidents and congresses and all the rest, right? You following me? So it's back then that Napoleon III, the great Napoleon from France, who kind of brings France into some kind of sanity after the French Revolution, he meets with Ferdinand Maximilian. He meets him at a baptism party of Napoleon and his wife Eugenie. And so Ferdinand Maximilian leaves a favorable impression on the Emperor Napoleon. And so Napoleon says, Mexico will have an emperor. he sees the problem going there. We got to put an emperor just south of the United States so that this new idea of a republic will not change the world. Well, we know what happened. Anyways, okay, let's see if we can continue the story. And I want to share with you more of how Our Lady Guadalupe plays into this story vis-a-vis the fullness of the Catholic faith versus, shall we say, watered-down version of the Catholic faith. Anyways, let's take that second break. Okay, Nick, are you there? We will be right back. I am Father Tom Coyes, guest host on the Winds of Change, and you are listening to the new EWTN Catholic Radio Voice for Chicagoland, WSFI Catholic Radio, and on AM 750 WNDZ, and on 88.5 FM.
Here's some good news. We are pleased to announce that St. Stanislaus Kostka is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in answer to our Blessed Mother's call to open the doors the Blessed Sacrament will again be exposed all day, every day, except when masses or other services are being held. You are invited to come and pray anytime, day or night. For your safety, we ask that you practice social distancing and wear a mask. Hand sanitizer is available, and St. Stan's has increased cleaning and sanitizing of the church, and a security person will be on site. More information can be found at ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org. St. Stanislaus Kostka is located two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway.
We are the students of St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy.
Your children can join them for face-to-face classroom instruction. Visit ststandschicago.org to find out how.
And you're listening to the Winds of Change.
The Spirit of Advent with Father Dominic Legg.
In the liturgical season of Advent, we commemorate two comings of Christ. The first coming as a baby at Christmas, a coming in meekness and humility, laid in a manger in Bethlehem. The second coming of Christ, though, is his coming as King at the end of time. Coming in power and glory, the King of justice and peace, coming to heal all divisions and to establish the reign of God. So we might ask this Advent, are there problems in my life, in my family, in my neighborhood, in my country? Certainly the answer is yes. Can Christ come to heal the problems, to heal the divisions, to establish his justice? Of course he can. So let's ask Christ to reign this Advent, to reign in my life, in my family, in our country, in our world. This would be a wonderful grace this Advent.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. Father Tom Coyce here, Brain Wrinkling Wednesday, or if you're listening on the podcast, whatever day you're listening it to, I'm in the middle of Our Lady Guadalupe Novena. Even though it's not really a Mexican neighborhood I'm in now, I've spent many years in a Mexican neighborhood parish. I actually was a trilingual parish, but obviously the Mexican people are very much a part of Chicagoland landscape and heart and soul of the church. So it's good to dive in and appreciate where they came from, what the history is, and especially to smell out or sniff out some of the errors. It's always good to learn from our past errors, right? And you could be very proud of where you come from. You can be very proud of your nation. And love is, as a matter of fact, you should be. There's a virtue in patriotism, which is kind of not appreciated so much these days, but it is alive in many people. And yet you want to do better than you did in the past. And one of the things you can't help but see when you look back at the history of Mexico is that the forces first, the anti-Catholic forces, vis-a-vis especially the Masons, who really tried to infiltrate the church, they were trying to deconstruct the Catholic Church in Mexico, and certainly did a lot. They succeed in a lot of ways, though people didn't necessarily abandon their identity as Catholic. They just accepted the criticism of the fullness of the faith that the Masons wanted them to do. Many Masons would have wanted and tried to get people to abandon their Catholic faith, but they found out they wouldn't do it. But at least you could sort of achieve the same purposes if you let people wear the identity of Catholic, but you give up the beliefs in Catholicism. And that's a big danger. That happened in France. We call that the Huguenot movement. Those were the French that loved the Protestant Reformation and wanted to bring down Catholicism in France. So the same thing was happening in Mexico too. So anyways, we're going to take up the story again. Let's go to October 1858, okay? 1858, Napoleon III meets with Don Manuel José Hidalgo and Juan Almonte. Now, those names may not mean a lot to you if you're not familiar with much of Mexican history, but Hidalgo and Almonte, actually, Almonte Morales, there's a big city in Mexico called Morelio, and these were the guys, they were named after Hidalgo. Unfortunately, they're two sons of two priests that were part of the revolution. So you could see how the fullness of the Catholic priesthood wasn't exactly appreciated. We could see such a thing as a scandal, but of course that's just the way it is. Anyways, these two sons of the two founding priest revolutionaries, both of whom were executed by the Spaniards, they're out there in France now talking to Napoleon III, and Napoleon III wants to establish a monarchy in Mexico. Partly he thought that a monarch would collect debts and pay the money that is owed to France, but especially to keep the United States from gaining power on the world scene as a republic, a non-monarchy. See, that's what he was afraid of. All the monarchs were worried about the United States growing like that. And, we know that part of the, you know, most of that story. Okay, one of the things when Benito Juarez does become president, now we're in 1859, so about a year later, he becomes president, and he nationalizes the churches. He didn't want to destroy the churches, but he nationalized the churches. This is something, I never really realized this, but you know, that's what England did with the Catholic Church, with Henry VIII, of course, and Thomas Cranmer, his official archbishop that did most of his church doings. Anyways, so the fact that Benito Juarez nationalized the church was way back in 1859, obviously set a precedent. And of course, it's kind of what the problem in China is experiencing now too, and that's kind of another reason why I'm leery about giving too much accolades to Pope Francis, because any time government officials want to nationalize the church, there's trouble because they're going to use the church for their purposes more than to be sure they're teaching and creating true disciples of Christ, right? So that's something quite important to remember. So we're getting a little bit farther. This is the time of the musical chairs when one president goes in and one president goes out. So the next year, 1860, a man by the name of Miramón becomes president, and he's going to get his army and attack Benito Juarez's army. Again, they're both, Benito Juarez was full-blooded Indian and Miramón was Indian and Spanish. So, but they both had their armies and they would clash. So that's what they did. And so Benito Juarez was hanging out in Veracruz. Many people know where Veracruz is. It's one of the nice places for vacations these days. So Miramón tries to lay siege to Veracruz to force Benito Juarez to surrender. Unfortunately, the United States intervenes. There's an American Navy captain by the name of Turner. They sail down there and capture Miramón's ships. Well, of course, Benito Juarez was very happy that gave Benito Juarez a chance to get away. And plus, the United States gave a whole boatload of money to Benito Juarez to keep fighting against Miramon, which is kind of not right because the United States had backed Miramon, and now they're kind of double-crossing him. And, might I add, Miramon was a more faithful Catholic, not as filled with scandals in their personal life as Benito Juarez and his gang. So anyways, going a little bit farther, President Miramon does win one battle against Benito Juarez at the Battle of Toluca. The Battle of Toluca in the September of 1860. He captures a guy by the name of Gomez Farias. And he only imprisons him in the National Palace. The reason that's very important is, again, it shows Miramon as a more merciful and less likely to execute all his enemies, which a lot of others would have done right away. Gomez Farias also becomes president back and forth in the musical chairs time of the presidency. So we have Miramon gaining a little bit of power and authority, and he's hoping the United States either will help him or at least stay out of the fight, as it were. So, let me see, where did I go? Let's see. Here we go. Now we're into 1861, and Benito Juarez is chased out of the capital, Mexico City, often called DF, the District Federal, the Federal District. So he goes to Europe this time, and so Benito Juarez, when he comes back, he pushes Miramon out of the presidency, and he becomes president. And again, he issues a declaration that is called, he calls for, we will just not pay our debts to Europe, especially France. So that pisses, gets Napoleon mad, right? It's kind of like I just heard on the news the other day that one of the representatives in the United States, House of Representatives, was just saying, we're not going to pay our college debts. We just declare.
Oh, when will this mad whirlwind existence ever stop?
It just keeps going and going. And so the point here especially is that there's these two kinds of Catholic figures being interwoven, one being more traditional, less likely to exercise, the vicious application of executing your enemies, the ones who are trying to forgive or give someone a second chance, as it were, like Miramon, as opposed to Benito Juarez. But both would call themselves Catholic, and yet Benito Juarez was being influenced by the Masons and also the new movement being born in Russia with the Bolsheviks and the communist movement. That was starting to affect them. So here's another little tidbit from Benito Juarez's first days in office. He was president like 12 different times because he stepped in and stepped out. He would step out to go fight in different battles. He declares another plan called the Plan of Tacubaya, which supported Zuluaga as president. It deports the cardinal of Mexico City, who supported Zuluaga, who was also a native Indian, actually. So Benito Juarez, in order to go capture the capital, just marches in with his army. There's a tremendous riot that begins. Many of the libraries are just destroyed. Precious ivory carvings and paintings are destroyed, burned in the city, streets and what have you. A guy by the name of General Gonzalez Ortega, who we met a little bit ago, I think I mentioned him, who's one of Benito Juarez's right-hand man generals. General Gonzalez Ortega said the riots were so bad when they marched into Mexico City that Ortega compares these riots to the destruction of Jerusalem. If you remember from your history, the destruction of Jerusalem when the Roman Empire flattened Jerusalem, destroyed the temple. So that's what Benito Juarez's right-hand man general thought about Benito Juarez's orders or marching into Mexico City to claim the presidency. This is like the Civil War, and it's not Indians versus Spaniards anymore. It's everyone's mixed blood just about, and it's hard to find rhyme and reason to it all. Okay, well, let's take another break. See if I could come up with a wrap up. This is just a tip of the iceberg, of course, in the whole story, but. I don't know, I hope you find it kind of fascinating as I do, especially because this is the neighbor to the south, and so much isn't really known. And when we abandon a strong fullness of the faith, all sorts of other chaos pursues. Anyways, okay? So anyways, I am Father Tom Coy's guest host on the Winds of Change. You are listening to the new EWTN Catholic Radio Voice for Chicagoland, WSFI. And on AM 750 WNDZ.
Here's something that you should know about what's happening at St. Stan's. The Daughters of St. Mary of Providence Religious Order operates the Providence Soup Kitchen on the premises of St. Stanislaus Kostka Parish. The soup kitchen serves a midday meal Monday through Thursday from 11:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Anyone who needs a meal is welcome. If you can volunteer to help and serve meals on a regular basis, please call Sister Darlene at 773-870-2435. That's 773-870-2435. St. Stan's is located two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway.
I'm Father Tom Coys, Winds of Change guest host, and you are listening to the Winds of Change.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy. St. Stan's is an exceptional private elementary school in Chicago, serving preschool, age 3 and 4, pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, and first grades. We incorporate Catholic values and rigorous academic social-emotional learning, Chinese, Spanish, STEM, and more, providing our students with leadership and life skills to transform our world. St. Stanislaus Kostka Academy is conveniently located one block north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. To schedule your tour, visit ststanschicago.org. ststanschicago.org.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. God bless you. I am trying to give you a little history stuff here because we're in the middle of the novena to Our Lady Guadalupe. And even if that's not tops on your devotional list, it really is a beautiful devotion because Our Lady Guadalupe is such a powerful fact of history. And it intertwines with the relationship between the United States and Mexico. It intertwines with the relationship between what was going on in Europe and what was going on in the New World. It intertwines between how a Catholic culture will proceed and how a Protestant culture will proceed. It highlights the mistakes, you could say, of both in different ways. And so we need to appreciate the fullness of the story. I mentioned earlier that the Catholicism was declared the official religion of Mexico in a number of different ways until it had to be stamped out. But even when it was officially called the official religion of Mexico, there were a lot of forces that were trying to weaken Catholicism. Catholicism was wedded to monarchs for many, many years, of course. And what we need to be able to see today is that one of the Catholic principles of the relationship between church and state has to do with the fact that faith in Christ, being a good Catholic, being a good Christian for that matter, obviously, can happen within the realms of different political systems. And going back to the classical Greek philosopher classifications of different political systems, obviously we have the pure democracy, we have the republic, we have the oligarchy, and we have the monarchy, those kind of four classical systems of government. And it's so key to appreciate the fact that us Catholics would say that we can be happy in each of them, or we can be miserable in each of them, because there can be a good form of democracy and a bad form, a good form of a republic and a bad form of a republic, a good form of oligarchy and a bad form, a good monarch and a bad monarch. So that explains to some extent, my friends, why oftentimes Catholicism seems to take a back seat or a neutral seat with regards to politics, because they bishops and popes will say, hey, well, if the argument is just about do you want to be a republic or a monarchy, or do you want to be a democracy versus a republic, we'll stay out of that fight because we'll adapt and work with whichever system you want. Unfortunately, this relationship between the United States and Mexico illustrates a very important part, I think, that that fear that was in Napoleon as an emperor, who saw the democracy of the French Revolution, or you know, the people will rule. As a matter of fact, the another little interesting tidbit of history. Do you know how we often use the words left and right? That comes from the French Revolution, because the in those early parliamentary councils that they had, the people on the left side were the more radical, tear down the institution, and damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead kind of revolutionaries, and the people on the right were more like the compromise, let's see if we can work together kind of representatives or people in the they didn't call it the parliament at that time. Anyways, so what's key for us is we could see our Blessed Mother was trying to help out all the people by inspiring the true faith, and there are other considerations beside the four types of government. You have to have the right moral compass. You have to have the right attitude about marriage. You have to have the right attitude about property. You have to have the right attitude about what will help the most people, the worshiping God, how to let people worship God with freedom as they would have. And Catholicism so often is targeted as the problem. We have to be watchful of that, because, boy, as I hear the ending music come up, I certainly see how that's a part of our world today. So stay faithful, my friends. Pray to the Blessed Mother. Especially appreciate her as the patroness of the unborn and the patroness of the Americas, right? I'm Father Tom Coyes, sitting in for Father Anthony Bush on the Winds of Change on EWTN, Catholic Radio Voice for Chicagoland, WFSI 88.5 and 750 WNDC.
Can you see the winds have changed? We marvel and flatter such meaningless thought, the the shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide the wind.